And my Bible studies and sermons sometimes look very similar. So if this, some of it seems like a sermon, it has been used as a sermon, and I've also used it as a Bible study. So now, for the books that I am to push. This publication is really, really good, because my professors are the ones who write it. Seminex, you all know of Seminex. The old journal that they used to put out was called CTM, Concordia Theological Monthly. Well, when they went into exile, they kept the CTM, only named it Currents in Theology and Mission. It's still CTM. It's a nice little book. This particular issue was dedicated to a man named von Rohrsauer. And so there are a lot of Old Testament articles. The one that I use a lot in here is called Righteousness, Human and Divine by Carl Gresser, who is now in the deployed faculty at PLTS in Berkeley. These are selling, I believe, for $2.80 in the bookstore. So please buy them, since they ordered them special. It's a good journal, too. It really has a lot of appeal if you aren't a theologian like me. One other book that I told him to order, and I won't be using it now, so I told him I'd push it every session. It's a little book called Advice to a Young Wife from an Old Mistress. It's 130 pages, and it's a marvelous little book if you're married or not. I'm thinking of using it with premarital sessions. It's a woman who was a mistress for a number of years of a fairly prominent man. You never can figure out who it is, though. She's cleverly disguised. But it has a lot of good, helpful things, I think, for people who are married. And I recommend it. It's not in yet, but it will be. Okay, now, Quilts, Righteousness, and Tamar. When I was growing up in Sunday school, I kind of got the notion, when you'd hear the word wicked, that wicked people were people who did naughty things. And you didn't want to be wicked. Oh, that's wicked. You didn't want that said of you. That wasn't a nice thing. But something righteous was really good. You'd done something really terrific if it was righteous. Well, I come to find out after a while that that's not the original biblical words for righteous and wicked. The way the terms righteous and wicked originated were in a legal sense. That if two people were in a dispute, they would go down to the village gate and talk to these elders who sat there all day. I don't know how they made livings, but anyway, they sat at the village gate and they would settle disputes. And say two men had a dispute over a sheep, they would come and present their case to the village elders, and then the elders would decide who was in the right and who was in the wrong. The one who was in the right in this particular case with the sheep was called righteous. The one who was in the wrong in this particular case was wicked. Now, it might be, these were not general moral categories. The person who was declared righteous in this situation might generally be a lout. But in this case, in relationship to this person over this one sheep, he might be righteous and the other one wicked, because he was in the wrong relationship in this litigation. So righteousness originally was a relationship term. How are you with your fellow peers? Are you in the right relationship with them? It's also a word of faithfulness. If you are righteous with that relationship, you are living faithfully with them. Now, that word then expanded, still in the legal sense, to refer to the judges. Those judges who sat in the gate also were judged by the divine judge. And if these judges did not judge rightly, the human judges, they were wicked judges, because they were not judging rightly, not judging in favor of the righteous one. And God, the divine judge, whose righteousness goes without saying, would then judge the wicked judges. And as that term then further developed, by the time of the Psalms, when God is referred to as the righteous one, he is the one who is the rescuer, because he decides in favor of whoever the deserving person is. And by the 8th century in Palestine, in Israel, there were many wicked judges, many people of power who did not decide in favor of the oppressed person, the person who was in the right. And so God became the rescuer of the needy. and then by, of course, New Testament usage, Jesus is the one who rescues us, and he is righteous, and he makes us righteous. That means he puts us on a right relationship with him. He is faithful to us, and then we are called to be faithful to him and to his people. Now I want to tell you a story. We will get to Genesis 38, never fear. I want to tell you a story about when we were in North Dakota. We were there for 3 years. We've been a year now in Carson City, Nevada. And we were in Las Vegas before this period, good old Sin City. And I'd been working there and going to Jamestown. My husband would be working, but I didn't have a job. Well, I had all kinds of romantic notions about learning to quilt and bake bread and all these kind of homespun, dreamy things, you know. Wasn't that way, but those were my notions starting out. And my notion of church quilting before I got there was all of these women would sit around this big frame and with very fine stitches, and they had Band-Aids because they were always pricking their fingers, make these marvelous little designs and sell these beautiful quilts for a couple $100 at their Christmas bazaar. Well, the church that we were at in North Dakota had a very different way of making quilts. There was one woman in charge when we got there. Her name was Gladys, and she was continuing the tradition of her mother, who had lived to, oh my, I don't know if she was 100, nearly 100. And this grandma, she died just before we arrived, would make like 100 and some quilts on her own throughout the winter. And so Gladys, her daughter, who also worked full-time cleaning toilets at the college, she would go from like 6 to noon or whatever, and then 1 o'clock on Wednesdays in the summertime, she would sit at church all afternoon making quilts till 7 in the evening, continuing her mother's tradition. What they would do, sometimes she'd get other women to work with her, but sometimes she sat alone. They would find bags of clothes from rummage sales. They'd go to the thrift store, buy a whole bag, a grocery bag of clothes for a quarter or whatever. And then some poor soul had the job of trying to cut these clothes up into more or less squares. They weren't always squares. Often they weren't rectangles. They weren't even trapezoids. Just sort of shapes. And Gladys, who hauled her trundle machine down to the church, they lived out in the country some, I don't know, 5 miles, would just sew these things up. I don't know how she made them work, but she made them fit. And then we'd have tables set out, and some of us would, you know, practically break our backs tying these quilts. The batting, by the way, was just old curtains or old bedspreads. I mean, they were just atrocious things. I almost hated to put my time in on these ugly things. And I commented sometime, you know, well, couldn't we make them a little nicer? And what I was told is that these particular quilts would make it to the people who need them. That the fine quilts that were sent overseas were ripped off on the black market and sold. And so the people who needed ground covers and tents wouldn't get anything. And these ugly old things made it through. And I was a little more content. But anyway, one of the things that I was working on in North Dakota was cleaning out junk. And I have a whole theology developed on throwing away junk, which I will do next week. But I was struggling with getting rid of junk and you know, whether I should get rid of some of my high school clothes and stuff. And Gladys told me that she had 5 sisters. And these 5 sisters all lived in the area, and they had the same set of clothes, and they just passed around. Every 2 months, she'd move the next set on. And whenever it came back to Gladys, if she hadn't worn it in a year, she says, "I just bring it down here and cut it up." And I thought, oh, well, that's a great way to do it, okay? That's how you get your quilts. So anyway, on the basis of this, I developed a story, which is not true, in case any of you know Gladys. I once told it in a sermon, and afterwards somebody said, "Say that Gladys, is she da-da-da-da-da?" And they knew her, and it was 50 miles away, so... this is not true, in case you know Gladys. This is the story. Sally, who was a member of the congregation, came to church one morning, and as often it's still chilly in the morning, so she wore a nice sweater. But then by the time for coffee afterwards the service, she was really hot, so she took her sweater off and laid it on the back of her chair, folding chair. Then she went up to get her third cup of coffee, and someone else came along and wanted to sit there. So they moved her sweater to a nearby place, which happened to be Gladys's stack of material ready to be cut up. And then Sally walks off and forgets the sweater. This is Sunday. Wednesday, Gladys comes along, nice sweater, but haven't worn it in a year, so you cut it up and sew it into a quilt. Well, by next Sunday, Sally's missing her sweater, and she accosts Gladys and says, you cut my sweater up and put it into a quilt. Okay, so then these two women go down to the coffee shop, the city gate, and they talk to the elders who are there every day, Herb and Paul, and they tell their story to these elders. Now, there are two endings to this story. Story A is presented this way. Sally has a lot of clothes, and she is careless with her clothes. And after her sweater got moved to the heap, she saw it there. But she didn't want to be bothered with it on this fine Sunday, and so went off to dinner, and as they all do, and did not worry about it, knowing full well that it might get cut up into a sweater. But then when she sees that it's been cut up, then she expects Gladys to repay her the sweater. Gladys' side of the story in number A is that she saw it there, did not know that it was something special to Sally, and in all innocence cut it up and sewed it into a quilt to be shipped off to people who needed it. In story A, righteous judges would decide that Sally is wicked. In this particular case, despite her fine moral credentials in the community, in this particular case, in this relationship with Gladys, she's wicked. And Gladys, in this particular case, in regard to her relationship with Sally, is righteous. Story B. Sally has only one sweater. And in North Dakota, it gets cold sometimes, and you need to wear your sweater. In all innocence, she just walked out of church and forgot her sweater, did not see it sitting on Gladys's pile of cut-up bubbles, and really needs the sweater. And Gladys, in story B, is greedy. She is competing with a Missouri Synod church down the road to sew more quilts, and she will cut up anything in her path. And she knew that this was Sally's only sweater and that Sally was poor. And she didn't care. Now in story B, righteous judges would have to decide that Sally in this case is righteous and Gladys is wicked. I tell this story to illustrate the point that the very same action can be either righteous or wicked depending on the other circumstances. Now we get to Genesis 38. Do you have Bibles or memorized one or the other? How many of you don't know what's in here or haven't read it? It's very cleverly hidden. You may figure out why by the end. Well, if I'm introducing it to you, I'm delighted because it's one of my favorite stories. This, as I say, is very cleverly hidden. Chapter 37, last verse says, meanwhile, the Midianites had sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard. Chapter 39, verse 1, now Joseph was taken down to Egypt and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, da 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 da. Chapter 38 doesn't have anything to do with Joseph. This story is just dropped in there out of the blue, I guess because it fits best here. It's not told anywhere else, hardly mentioned anywhere else in the scriptures. Here's the story. Now Judah, you know who he was. He was one of the sons of Jacob, a patriarch, and a progenitor not only of King David, but of Jesus himself. He goes into the surrounding territory, the Canaanite territory, and he meets a man named Hira, who becomes his lifelong friend. And while Judah is there, he marries a Canaanite woman by the name of Shua, and they have three children, Onan, and Shelah. The firstborn, marries a woman named Tamar. And for some reason, displeased the Lord. We aren't told why, and God kills him. So according to Levirate law, which was, this is laid out in Deuteronomy, that if a man died and he had no children, it was the responsibility of his widow to marry the dead man's brother. The first child from that, the first son, from that union, then would carry on the name of his uncle, of the dead man. That would enable the name to be carried on, and the property to be inherited. That was really crucial. That's how the Jews didn't have, they weren't called Jews at this time, they did not have a notion of immortality, you know, like we do, the Greek notion of soul going to heaven and stuff, and that's how you lived on. You lived on by your family living on, carrying on the name and inheriting the property. That was really important. So, Tamar, the Jews say Tamar. Tamar sounds more euphonious to me, but Tamar then marries Onan, the second son. Now, Onan, the text says, spilled his seed on the ground, and God killed him. In other words, he was not willing for his first son to be named his brother's son. He wasn't going to do this. He wasn't going to go by the Levirate law. That's where we get the word Onanism, by the way. It's not a real direct connection by our language, but that's where it comes from. So, one son left, Shelah. Tamar says, I'm going to marry Shelah. Judah says, uh-uh. He has got the notion at this point that this woman is a bit of a jinx. Don't marry her. You may not survive it long. And you see, what was at stake is that Judah's inheritance is at stake. He has three sons, according to this. Shelah's gone. Judah doesn't have any immortality either. Nobody to pass his property on to. So he's nervous. And so he says to Tamar, he's too young. You don't want him yet. It's not going to be good. Oh, younger man, older woman, yeah, wait a bit. So she goes back to her father's house, which is where widows went if they were not welcome in their husband's family, and she wasn't at this point, put on her widow's weeds and dwelt there. We don't know how long. In the course of time, Judah's wife, Shua, dies. He goes to the mourning. He's been comforted, and he decides to take a bit of a vacation, a cruise, and so he goes up to go sheep shearing with his friend Hira, and they go up in the hills somewhere. And Tamar hears of this. It's a small village, and gossip is rife. And she hears that he's going up to Timnah. So she hatches a plan, and she takes off her widow's weeds, and she attires herself as a harlot. And she knows the road that he's going on. He's done this quite a bit in the past. And she waits by the side of the road. And here comes Judah, newly widowed, in need of comfort. And he approaches this woman. And she's smart, though. She asks for payment first. She says, what will you give me? He says, oh, I'll send you a sheep. And she says, that's fine. But what are you going to give me until I get the sheep? What for surety? And well, and he says, well, what do you want? And she says, I want your MasterCard and your Visa. And he's agreeable. He is in dire need of comfort. So they go in and do their thing, and then he goes merrily on his way. She, meanwhile, vacates the place, sneaks back home, puts on her widow's weed. Nobody's the wiser. Well, Judah is an honest man. However, he doesn't go himself. He sends his friend Hira with the sheep to pay off the prostitute. And Hira goes to the place, and there's no harlot here. Judah had described the place well. Exit 52. She wasn't there. She was not there. So Hira, this sheep in tow, goes around from bar to bar. Prostitute. You don't have one here. I don't know who you're looking for. So he toodles back to Judah and says, she ain't there. Judah says, fine. We tried. I'm not going to make a laughing stock of this whole issue. Just forget the whole thing. So, next scene. 3 months later, word goes round that Tamar is pregnant. Now, with those widow's weeds, I don't know how they all figured that out. And I'm sure she wasn't talking, but it was a small town, you know, and they get ideas. So anyhow, the word is that she is with child and by harlotry. Now, you need to remember that a woman who committed adultery sinned against her husband. This adultery was always against the man because it could screw up his inheritance. You wouldn't know who the father was. That's why Jews today, you have to have a Jewish mother to be a Jew. You always know who the mother of a child is. You don't always know the father. Okay, so that was always a sin against the husband. So in this case, Judah, being the husband's family, is the one who passes judgment on her. The judgment is that she should be burned. That was, according to the law, that punishment could be meted out for a woman who was an adulteress. So she's on her funeral pyre, going there, 25, as she was being brought out. She sends word to her father-in-law, and she flashes his MasterCard and his Visa. And she says, the man who owns these is the father of the child I'm carrying. And he says, by the grace of God, she is more righteous than I. Now, I find that just incredibly remarkable that this woman, who is an outsider in Israelite tradition, she's a Canaanite, probably pagan, she has played the harlot, and she has committed incest. And there were very harsh taboos against incest in the Old Testament. There still are, but they were even more vivid then. And he says, she is more righteous than I. Now, the reason that she is more righteous is because she was attempting to be faithful to the relationship she had with her dead husband. It was a patriarchal society, and we can judge however we want of what women's duty was or whether it was fair or not. Her responsibility as Ur's wife was to bear him a son. And she was attempting to be faithful to the relationship of this guy who's long dead, and Judah was getting in her way. And so she hatched whatever plot she could to do it. Now, if this would happen today in a small town, you can imagine what they're saying in the coffee shops. Oh, look what she's trying to pull off. She just thinks that she's so hot. She could have done something else. Well, I don't think she could have. Women didn't have much power then. And she was risking her life. He could have killed her. I mean, she embarrassed him royally, right in front of the whole community. You imagine in the crowd that gathered to see this burning? Better than a fire. I mean, you know, with fire engines. They all came out to watch this. And she flashes his cards. She embarrassed him in front of the whole community. She discredited him. He could have sent her double time to her death. He could have. She risked her very life to do this. She could have lost her entire objective, because if she had been killed, so would have the child. But I think she had no other options available to her, and she chose one that was considered very sinful, wicked, as we traditionally understand it, and very risky. Very risky. And then the story continues to tell of the two children she bore, twins, Perez and Zerah. Now, this woman, Tamar, the story doesn't end there, even though you rarely hear of it, although there are girls today, Jewish girls, who are named Tamar. It is, they know the tradition and they cherish it. Matthew chapter 1, the genealogy of Jesus, as Matthew tells it. It's different from Luke's, as you know, Luke 3 or 4, I forget the name. There are five women only mentioned in this long genealogy of Matthew's. One is Mary, the mother of Jesus. And the other four women are outsiders in some sense. One is Rahab, the prostitute, who gave shelter to the spies when they were checking out the land before the Israelites moved in to conquer. Rahab gave them safe shelter in her attic. Another one is Bathsheba, who committed adultery with King David, and on whose behalf David murdered her husband Uriah. Another woman is Ruth, the Moabitess, an outsider to the Jewish tradition. I think great-grandmother of David, or maybe great-great-grandmother. And the fourth woman is Tamar, also an outsider, a Canaanite, who committed adultery and incest. These are the only four women outside of Mary who are mentioned in Matthew's genealogy. We don't have Sarah, we don't have Rachel, we don't have Rebecca, we don't have Deborah, we don't have any of the matriarchs. You know, the good Jewish mamas, they ain't there. None of them are there. It's these women who are on the outside in some sense, either outside of the ethnic group, or who did something that was unsavory. And I think Matthew is giving us a clue right from jump in his gospel that righteousness does not depend not so much on who you are or what you've done, but what the divine judge declares you to be. in right relationship with him. And these women were in right relationship with him, regardless of their credentials. Somebody asked, that's basically the end of my presentation, but we're cautioned to have some questions ready. Someone at the end of the staff Bible study, didn't get the question in the group because I had to call time, asked me at the end, "Well, does this mean that the end justifies the means?" And I go, "Oh." that's the juggler, I guess, of this particular issue. And it can look that way. But I guess I'd throw that out to you. I'd like to hear some comments on how you feel about that, plus anything else you want to talk about.
Let me twist your question. Not does the end justify the means. If she had not had the son, she would have been more wicked.
I don't know. What do you think?
I think it's not the end point that is justification. It's the reason behind the cause.
The intentionality.
The intention.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the intent of the story is that she was attempting to be faithful to that relationship.
And so if she had not had a child, would she have been less wicked or more wicked? No.
Right. Yeah, I think that's... Mm-hmm.
And yet she still put it out in God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She could have failed in her end. Mm-hmm. Yeah, to give birth to a son. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You get all kinds of things coming up. A person needs a serious operation, has no money, so a friend goes and steals some money to pay the bill.
Yeah.
What are the consequences?
Is that righteous?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think this story is such a marvelous, kind of break open point for all kinds of ethical issues. Because she so clearly did what was not acceptable and was even wrong, you know, but yet was righteous.
And in this case, they would judge that to be a good deed, therefore the stealing of money is correct.
Yeah.
Isn't that part of the point with some of this, that it's iconoclastic, but it doesn't dismiss consequences? I mean, she could have been killed righteously. And it perhaps is simplifying this to say, because it was a good deed that she did the right thing. I don't think that that's really what comes at this, but from what I understand from your presentation is that the righteousness is there because of her relationship with her husband. I mean, she could have been a turkey in other mm-hmm. respects. In this particular issue, she is righteous.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a question of good deed. That's where the confusion comes in. It's not a good deed or a bad deed. It's a righteousness or wickedness issue. And that's something different.
Along with your first thought, and the story seems to just get included here. Well, I think that God is looking out for the line of where Jesus is going to be born. And so he was looking out for this all along. And so there couldn't be a break in the line. Judah's son had to, Judah had to have a son, a grandson, and a descendant all the way mm-hmm. down the line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's the crucial link for that. Mm-hmm. Right.
But God could choose anyone he wanted to, I think, without mm-hmm. having it. Relationship back then between.
Yeah. Well, and that's kind of the point. The guy who wrote this, so what historical critical methodology, they've developed a way of looking at the Pentateuch, and they say that there are four different authors. One of the authors they call the Yahwist, because he always refers to God as Yahweh, J in German. Yahweh starts with J in German, so it's called J.
Why?
Huh? Oh, I'm sorry, I thought you said something. And so he wrote at the time of either David or Solomon. Scholars debate it, and so I guess I don't have to give a definitive answer because I'm not a scholar. But anyway, he wrote at the time when the monarchy was at a top point, and they were very feeling powerful and kind of haughty about it. You know, we got all this power because we're so good. I mean, God chose us because we are worth it. We are really hardworking, and we go to church, and we are really decent folks. And so Jay, as a corrective to that kind of popular piety, said, well, there are some stories you need to know about your patriarchs who were chosen. So he tells this story of Judah. He tells the stories of Jacob, the shyster, when he's always wheeling and dealing and lying and cheating and so forth. He's the one who tells the story of Abraham trying to pass Sarah off as his sister to save his own neck and thus possibly screw up the promise. And the point was is that you aren't where you are because you're so terrific and you played all the odds right. You are where you are because God chose you. And we don't always know why, because it's not real logical why he chose some of you folks. But he blessed you to be a blessing. And whatever you have is for those poor and needy whom God has a bias for. And so some of these stories were written by him to make that perfectly clear to his audience that, you know, God chose you, period. Judah was not cut off for this. We don't hear of the story elsewhere. You know, it's not really mentioned. But Judah was not cut off. The line continued, and then Jesus was one of the descendants.
Just carrying on the same thought that was earlier spoken, that this still is a real dilemma for society.
Mm-hmm. So,
because they have the structures within the society function. What happens when a righteous act happens that completely breaks the society functions, and we don't have any system for handling it? Like these kids. The book has just been written. I read about these kids that have been sexually and emotionally abused for years and didn't know how to handle it. And finally, the young man killed the father. And there's just a book out recently some of you may have heard about. Well, they were sent to jail. They were tried as adults and sent to jail. And there's a lot of guilt feelings for those who are reading about it. So how can this possibly be right?
Mm-hmm.
And yet they did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting, though, and I think we need to make the distinction that Judah does not say that what she did was a righteous deed. He says she is more righteous. He does not say, and nowhere is it ever said, that what she did was a good deed or that what she did was righteous. It was wrong. But she was righteous. And I guess that's the tough dilemma that we always have, but because according to justice, Judah was right. He unwittingly committed adultery with her. You know, well, you might say, well, you shouldn't play around with prostitutes, then you wouldn't get in trouble with that. Well, that wasn't the issue here. The issue was adultery. That was the sin. Al, did you have your, okay.
Yes, my question is, why are we putting so much emphasis on her as a product for whatever she did? I think the guy, he was the big contributor. Whether she's a prostitute or what?
Pardon me?
Whether she was considered a prostitute or what, he is the big committer of the sin. We seem to be going against her in some way.
Adultery, though, was only committed by women. Wasn't in the Old Testament view that the man was, in a sense, innocent. It was the woman.
Yeah. Well, you know,
wrongdoer.
Yeah, in the Gospels, when that woman is brought out to be stoned, the woman caught in adultery, all by herself, I guess. There's no man there, you know. Now, if you take that literally, she was caught in adultery. You assume that there were nearby witnesses. There's no man. You know, and I guess it's a patriarchal story. And we don't live that way now, but I think we need to savor the best of the story, and we need to jump into that world and just, you know, work with it. Yeah, he's not judged. Nowhere does he get any condemnation. He was in the role of judge. He had the power to do whatever to her he wanted.
And he never got any condemnation for blocking God's will.
No, well, as it turned out, I mean, it ended up being God's will. Well, oh gosh, who am I to say what God's will is? Yes, he was preventing her from being faithful to her.
He was preventing what could have been. Then she was in the right. Did Sheila, and it doesn't say in this chapter, does it say any other place, you know, did Sheila have any descendants? If not, then Judah wouldn't have any descendants.
Well, oh gosh, that's getting technical. You know, there are a lot of genealogical places, and I'm not sure where they are. I maybe can hunt some up for you overnight, but...
Knew that
this was his only heir, that her child was his only heir. And so he says she's more righteous than I for his own safety? Well, he might have. I prefer to keep the edge on it and say that by the grace of God, he vindicated her.
In this case, the judge judged himself, that's righteous.
Yeah.
That's an interesting contradiction.
Yeah. Yeah. In Matthew, when it's verse 3, and Judah, the father of Perez, and Zerah by Tamar. If Sheila, well, see, I don't know how they'd work that out exactly. But the line continued through these children of Judah's and Tamar's. The line did not continue through Sheila.
But you have that problem with Jacob and Esau. The line goes to the younger.
Not just with them, but read on in Genesis 38, when the time of her, verse 27, when the time of her delivery came, there were twins in her womb. And when she was in labor, one put out a hand, and the midwife took it and bound on his hand a scarlet thread, saying, "This one came out first." We are going to be very particular about who's the firstborn here. But as he drew back his hand, behold, his brother came out, and she said, "What a breach you have made for yourself." Therefore, his name was called Perez, which means what? I don't know. A breach, okay. Afterward, his brother came out with a scarlet thread upon his hand, as his name was called Zerah. Now, according to Matthew, the line continues through. I keep losing my place here. Who's it continued through, according to Matthew? Which one? Perez, the one who made a breach. That's an interesting little twist, too. I mean, even... It kind of reminds me, Luke has this, you know, the Magnificat, about God upsetting, turning everything upside down. The powerful are going to be at the bottom, the ones at the bottom are going to be lifted up. And God just turns things topsy-turvy, and sometimes our attempts to keep everything real neat and tidy for God, he just will not stand for it. He just upsets it all the time. And so you have this little dilemma here. Well, who was firstborn? I mean, she's trying to produce a firstborn son for her husband, and she goes to all of this trouble, risks her life, and then you got this added dilemma. You don't really know who was firstborn after all, you know?
And why weren't the children named after her parents, her first husband?
Well, that wasn't always done, but it carried, you know, the tradition, the family name was, they didn't always have the name of their father. But, and I don't know, you know, well, they'd be Ben Judah would be the last name, or Ben Ur, I don't know which, not to be confused with Ben Hur. I'm not real up on those niceties. You probably need a rabbi who could untangle that, who is skilled in Midrash or something, work out those permutations.
One thing interesting about hearing the story, again, I'd be curious to know how many people here who have been in communities where there have been some issues around values clarification in public schools. And I haven't been really as close to this, as I'm sure some of you have been, but I am, at least I've heard of the famous alligator in the river story, and somebody maybe knows that story, but it doesn't I do. But I couldn't help but think of how usually it's the conservative religious people who are attacking the secular humanists for pushing values clarification curriculum into the public schools. And it's interesting to hear this story again and wonder if they know the story in the Bible too.
Yeah.
Because I think it deals with some of the same kinds of issues.
There's a problem getting a boat across. You can't take both across at the same time. Anyway, he goes over and says, I'll bring you both back safely across the river, but you've got to sleep with me. But if you don't sleep with me, I'm going to leave you both here, and on the other side, the army answer attack, something like that. So she's got to make a decision for them both. Is they both get eaten alive, or are they both saved? But she has to play.
Who is righteous in that story?
Yeah. Well, there are a lot of. Go ahead.
This story here, I don't think just talks about value clarification. I think if this thing breaks values, it breaks everybody's values, because the point of this, from Judah's side, I think, is that he, aside. Within this framework of the story, he can say that what she has done is wrong, and it is wrong. It's wrong, and it's wrong, and it's wrong, and it's wrong, and on the other side of it is, it's right, it's right, it's right. She is trying to remain faithful, and from his perspective, she could say, he hasn't allowed his older son to have an heir. But that doesn't make him unrighteous. It breaks values. It breaks conservative values, and it breaks liberal values. It throws the whole thing up in the air and says that the way that we live, what defines us as righteous, lies outside of our capability of living that righteous life, and that we have to depend upon God's sense of making us righteous, or somebody outside of us declaring us.
I think we need to probe and ask why did she bother to be faithful to her dead husband? I mean, she could have just passively sat at home and said, it's Judah's fault. I can't do it. You know? I mean, this is a patriarchal society. Why should she assert herself into being an assertive or an aggressive woman? I mean, why bother? And why was Judah balking? I think that the issue are issues of survival and issues of life. She was willing to risk her survival because she knew that God had her life in hand. And when you know that God has your life in hand, not just your whether you will live or die or have immortality, then you can begin to be faithful to other people. You can let go of the stranglehold you have on your own survival. Her raising up a son was not just for her husband. Her status as a woman in that community was whether she produced children. You know what happened to Hannah? She had no children. She was just prostrate in grief. She had no son, no children, but no son, especially. And her own opinion of herself and how the community viewed her was dependent upon producing children.
Well, more than that, it was Social Security.
Sure it was. But she was able to let go of that survival issue, I think, because she risked her life. She could have been burned. She knew it. And she waited till she was going to her funeral pyre. And Judah was worried about losing his inheritance. He didn't want to risk Sheila to this jinx. And I think that we have to say we have no evidence that she believed in Yahweh. But I think we have to say at some level she picked something up from this family she married into who were not interested in caring for one another and raising up sons for the other ones. Not the sons, not the father. She picked something up and she learned to trust God so that she could begin to be faithful. And I think all of us do that. Whenever the gospel gets through and we can a little bit trust God. And I think it's only that we do it by a little bit every day, which is why Martin Luther talked about daily confession and daily drowning and coming to new life, because none of us have a God together. We never do, not for more than 3 or 4 minutes at a time. And, you know, and she was at every 3 or 4 minutes at a time able to trust God.
I think that we don't always have a choice of a righteous path.
That's right.
We've got to take the path we think the most righteous. Or maybe we don't even know which one's the most righteous. Mm-hmm. And say, God, forgive me.
That's right.
And go ahead.
A friend of mine, well, a professor at Valpo, a friend too, Fred Niedner, talked about the double bind that we often are in terms of choices. This seems good, but then it's also bad, and this, you know, you've often got more bads to choose from. He said what you do in cases like that is that you choose the most loving thing for all concerned, as far as you can tell, at that moment in time, because you have to make a decision. And then, if afterwards you find out it was a good decision, you do not have any more brownie points with God. And if you find out it was a bad one, God does not cast you off. And that has probably been the most helpful thing to me. I mean, it's too easy to not make a decision because you can't decide, you know. And sometimes you lose the moment, the kairos, to do something. But it also, I think, reflects what Martin Luther said, that a good work is anything that a Christian does in faith. Isn't that awful? A good work is anything that a Christian does in faith, trusting God. Now that not only goes at our ethics, but I think it really hits at the heart of our unbelief that we don't want to allow God to decide what good works are. We don't trust Him to say what the good works are. We are going to decide on ourselves by reasons of value clarification and this law and that law and da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. But the real radical trust is to let God decide what the good works are.
Are you then suggesting that we don't have to take any responsibility for thinking about it?
No.
I gather you're not.
No.
You still throw yourself
a No.
God. You go as far as you can and then throw yourself.
Yeah. I mean, she took a lot of responsibility.
I would be so much happier if you could hear some of her interior thinking about this, how difficult this is.
Yeah.
Because it seems to me that we read that story rather from a distance, but what I wonder is what kinds of our own rules are we called to examine and perhaps even indulge in? Do I go against myself or my own safety? What is God calling me to do there?
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at Bible stories on the basis of lawbreakers doing the will of God, it's very interesting screen to look at that.
But then I
don't like it, but it comes down to me.
I know. Yeah, we have nothing of what she thought.
I think of the terrible pain you read about that Bonhoeffer went through.
Yes.
You know, the German theologian who was involved with a possible plot to kill Hitler, and they struggled for years. It's documented before they finally made the decision to commit the sin and said, this is a sin, this is wrong, but it's a righteous act.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we trust God to declare us righteous, even in our sinning.
Now, I think one thing that's is we don't think that God is judgment. God is turning things around right within the story.
Yeah.
If you start out with either a good or bad decision, God can make what you think good turn out ashes, or what you think bad can turn out good.
Mm-hmm.
He's active in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Gary.
Can you explain righteousness again? At least in the Jerusalem Bible, says that she is in the right rather than I. It seems to be that somehow the action might be right. The use of the action is wrong. I know in the RSV it says righteous, I think. See, we can pick that up. But I don't know the Hebrew here. But it sounds like she is in the right, like what she did was right. Maybe
she's in the right relationship. I'm mainly going with that. I imagine that what is behind it, I didn't bring my Hebrew Bible. The suitcase was just too full. Although it may be here. Let's see. What is
I mean, but is it important for us to say that what she did was wrong? We could, what she did was also right, and it was righteous as well.
Is it important for us to decide at all?
Yeah. Either one. Why do we have to say that the act is wrong? Could the act also be the right thing to do?
Yeah. I guess I would, if we get too caught up with trying to decide degrees of rightness, you know, well.
I mean, there's a piety here that says that she really did this bad thing. So, you know, we have to say that what she did was bad, but God saved the day anyway.
According to the law, it was wrong. The thing is that we are always all wrong according to the law. I mean, we cannot find any good thing, you know. I mean, she was concerned about, well, we don't know her words. But I would imagine that she was concerned about her own reputation and wanting to be a mother. That was important to her, too. And is that selfish? Yeah, selfish. God justifies it.
Another point, moving back to Onan, I've always looked at that passage that why Onan died was not that he was not faithful, but it was the whole spilling of the semen, that it was the potential of life, or that which was life. It was a misuse of life, and there was kind of a biological misunderstanding of what was life all about, and that women were basically incubators, and that the totality of life is what was contained in the man's semen. And therefore, homosexuality, masturbation, coitus interruptus, and all of that were all terrible sins. And that's how we got into all of that stuff.
That, you could be right. I don't know. The way I perhaps have even read this, I don't remember now, is that the point of the story is that she is blocked from producing an heir. And so then Onan's sin is interpreted in that light, that he was not willing for his first child to be regarded as his brother's. But you could be right. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah.
I think that as long as we remember that this is oral history and it is Jewish history written by and for the Jewish people, by Jewish men, we don't work so hard to try to make it a Christian message. We accept it as our rule, but it's not the New Testament.
Go on a little more with that, please.
I don't know what you want me to say.
Well, I just, what do you mean by working so hard to...
I don't know how much we can judge what is right or what is wrong, but rather be more accepting that this is a faith story of the Jewish people that gave us the Christ. And so it eventually becomes a thanksgiving for the Jewish people who gave us the Christ.
I think it's our story too, though. Paul tells us, yeah, but Paul talks about the Jews being the vine or the tree that God chose, and we Gentiles have been grafted on. So I think it is our story too, and the continuity of the idea of being declared righteous is there in the Old Testament, and Matthew picks up on it. I mean that. We're in that line too.
I agree with that. But it's not our Christian message. It's not the New Testament. It is a story of the Old Testament.
And therefore,
we thank God for our people, for what is there. And for the exception of the type that you have to use.
But then, what does that have to do about its meaning for us? That's what I'm wanting to push you on.
I have no right to talk as if I are sound as if I'm a professor.
I'm not either.
By one who has been a follower of the Jewish culture.
What can we push the story though to have meaning for us? I guess I'm asking you that. Can we wrestle with it and say this does have something to say to who we are as Christians and how we live? Does it?
This is only a personal opinion.
Well, that's fine. I mean, some of what I do.
I think that
at all.
We can do that. Uh-huh. But I think you always have to remember there is one in the Old Covenant story and one in the New Covenant story. One is older.
But I don't think that the things are nearly that clear cut. I remember Ralph Klein, talking at a convention that in Isaiah he said this is a new covenant and the old covenant is gone. He's talking about Isaiah now. This is Old Testament stuff, and the old covenant was based on the law. This new covenant that I am declaring now is that you are. I mean, this is a wild, my own wording of this thing, but the new covenant is that you are my people. Not you are my people if, but you are my people. And that's the same kind of declaration that we get from Christ. You are my people, not you are my people when you do this, or if you do this, or only this, but you are my people now, and you shall be my people. And that's exactly how we are constituted as part of that community too, because we're certainly not a part of that of this story of this line. At least most of us aren't. That we are not children or heirs. We have been graciously pulled in as even adopted children, and so that's the power.
I have the right to continue this conversation because I'm not, you know, a professor. But if Klein gentle, I think from my experience and my background that when we interpret it, we should interpret it as the Jewish people would interpret it, because it was their history written by them. Their oral history.
But
are you
a little bit like one person.
Are you Jewish?
No.
Oh,
my mother.
And my father. Okay. And a person cannot speak for a people. I mean, each person is going to interpret this always. And there are a number of Jewish people who would understand this story in completely different ways. It's not as if it's a monolithic faith that lies behind any of it. Lord knows when we look at the Lutheran churches trying to unite, you can find enough division in that. You don't have to go very far away.
I want
to. My only point was that I think sometimes we try to take Jewish stories and we try to push it and make it.
I wouldn't deny that. I think that.
Yeah. I hope I wasn't doing that because I am. I'm trying not
no,
to
not
plunk. You know, I think Jesus,
that.
But no. But I think.
I'm just saying anything.
Yeah, you are accurate that I don't think we need to see Jesus behind every rock in the Old Testament, but the God who provided him, who gave him, has been graceful all along. Anyway, I want to get this. Was it your question? Yes.
I wanted to comment that to me it's an example of our will versus God's will, no matter whether you're Jewish or Christian, and the fact that we all believe in God is so significant. And to me, the story says a lot to me in a lot of different ways about God's will versus my will, and another issue of sex equity, which I think there's some implications in the story there too, but that's another issue. but I think it says to us, God has a purpose for us, whether we're Christian or Jewish, whether we really hit hard on the New Testament, the spirituality of how we look at this. And it speaks to me about the control I try to have over God, whether I'm Christian, Jewish, Buddhist, or whatever. You still have to try to control as a human being. I think that's part of our limitations, is to try to be controlling.
Mm-hmm. Also judging. And it speaks of judging. And we try really hard to be Pharisees a lot of the time. We really do. We have earned our way, and then something like this comes along and just topsy-turvy. And try as we may, we really are Pharisaic a lot of the time, and we really need stories like this to remind us that God's view isn't as narrow as ours.
Yeah, sure isn't. It's 10. I'm supposed to dismiss you on time. If you want to stay, that's fine. If you don't want to, you're free to go. Come back tomorrow. It's Hosea.